You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Love is a smoke made with the fume of sighs. Being purged, a fire sparkling in lover's eyes. Being vexed, a sea nourished with lover's tears. What is it else? A madness most discreet, a choking gall, and a preserving sweet. Now, you might recall those lines when you studied Romeo and Juliet in high school. That's from Act 1, Scene 1. What has love not been compared to? That was Shakespeare saying love is a lozenge you choke on, a noose you willingly offer your head to, a madness most discreet. Sigmund Freud, if you must, also agreed on love being a kind of madness. Love means never having to say you're sorry, said one famous line from Eric Segal's Love Story, or Khwahish, if you will, in Hindi films. That, in the modern age, that love means never having to say you're sorry seems to me a bit problematic. Love, I suppose, in this era, means never having to say you're sorry for saying insofar as. It was Valentine's Day and weekend this past week. Restaurants were overbooked, milk chocolate trays oversold, teddy bear sales spiked, and in the days after, their abandonment rates have as well. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, said Shakespeare. Love, he said, was no time's fool, and that it persevered and persisted through the ravages of time until death. But we, of course, have known love to recede with an alteration of a carrot to the left of the x-axis and the appearance of one wrinkle too many in the T-zone. The Bard of Avon might have thought love was a smoke made of sighs, but it appears modern loving is made of something less expressive and something more expensive. How did, just how did, red roses and chocolates and teddy bears and diamonds come to define love? You gotta ask yourself, bro, what's love got to do with it? And that is what we discuss today on a belated Valentine's Day episode on Digging Deeper with Money Control with me, Rakesh Sharma.
The Deep Dive podcast series.
What's love got to do with it?
But first, we have for you a Valentine's Day flashback. TLDR, lose your head. Become immortal. Just how did Valentine's Day come to be is what we start things off with. Valentine's Day is a day for celebrating love. Well, that's the maudlin marketing spiel anyway. It is what we are sold by marketing mavens around the world. A hallmark holiday, something that was concocted by Madison Avenue men. Simply put, the Mad Men. The truth is, despite what innumerable sitcoms and TV specials push as a day for spending with that special someone, or more than one, as the case may be, polyamory and all that, besides also spending on that someone, Valentine's Day has a terrifying backstory. Story. Like all worthwhile medieval stories, this one contains some brutal torture and a beheading. There, I have your interest now, so let's get right into it. You mawkish consumers of crass capitalism and hallmark holidays, the grim tale behind the day of love. The origins of Valentine's Day go back many centuries to ancient Rome. Well, yes, I agree, what European festival does not? Maybe perhaps in the future we'll also have a day for Brexit. That's going to be grim. Now, pagans certainly had more fun. Back to Rome, there is more than one legend around Valentine's Day, and the Catholic Church recognizes three different saints named Valentine or Valentinus, all of whom were killed. But first, the pagan legends behind this special day. If ever any people overdid anything, it was the Romans. Remember Caligula? Now watch that film called Caligula. It's, well, something. Sample this. Legend has it, from the 13th of February to the 15th of February, the Romans celebrated the Feast of Lupercalia. It was an ancient, perhaps even pre-Roman, pagan festival where the men sacrificed a goat and a dog, then worshipped women with the hides, the skins of the animals they had just slain. Yep, they whipped the women. Noel Lenski, who is a historian at the University of Colorado, told NPR that the Roman romantics were drunk, they were naked. Lenski added that young women would actually line up for the men to hit them. They believed this would make them fertile. Holy kink, Batman. This merry festival also included a matchmaking lottery in which young men drew the names of women from a jar. The couple would then be joined for the duration of the festival, or longer if the match was right. Swipe and right, Roman style. Some claim that the Christian Church may have decided to place St. Valentine's Feast Day in the middle of February in an effort to Christianize this pagan celebration of Lupercalia. Now, all of you who have consumed Dan Brown with great enthusiasm will, of course, remember what this appropriation stuff is all about. Lenski told NPR it was a little more of a drunken revel, but the Christians put clothes back on it. That didn't stop it from being a day of fertility and love, unquote. Trust the Christians to put some clothes back on. Slight correction there, I should have said the Catholic Church. Trust the Catholic Church to put some clothes back on. Now, returning to the many myths of Valentine's Day. And now, we also come to the beheading story. I imagine that was what you were waiting for, because I was. The Romans may also be responsible for the name of our modern day of love, i.e. Valentine's Day. Emperor Claudius II, whose reign started in the September of 268 and ended in January 270, that's about 2 years, executed two men, both named Valentine, on the 14th of February. Well, not at the same time. He was not that much of a monster. Claudius II was involved in many wars and wasn't exactly an emperor to be messed with. He decided that single men made better soldiers than those with wives and families. He outlawed marriage for young men. Valentine, realizing the injustice of this decree, defied Claudius and continued to perform marriages for young lovers in secret. When the priest's actions were discovered, Claudius ordered that he be put to death, off with his head, and hence the decapitation and the consequent head losing, yada yada yada. Thanks to this marital angle of his story, Valentine became the patron saint of love, young people, and marriages. And also the patron saint of plague, epilepsy, and beekeepers, but that is a story for another time. There are so many things and only so many saints. It's a grim economy in the pantheon of saints, and you just have to take on the extra job once in a while. Now, after the beheading, returning to Valentine's story, his remains remained in the catacombs of San Valentino for a while before moving to Santa Maria in Cosmedin, or the Basilica of St. Valentine in Terni, depending on the you choose to believe. There, the remains were visited by pilgrims for many years. They would probably have remained venerated, but anonymous relics for the patron saint of beekeepers and people suffering from the plague, had it not been for one Geoffrey Chaucer. Now that is a rude poet from the Middle Ages who wrote far too many fart jokes, and of course we love him for it, but we'll get to the Chaucer angle in just a minute. Another vaguely similar myth is also mixed up with the roots of Valentine's Day. St. Valentine of Terni, which is a town in central Italy, is said to have been killed by royal decree in the year 269 or thereabouts on the 14th of February. According to legend, the Roman physician and priest Valentinus was beaten, stoned, and beheaded for the crimes of marrying Christian couples and possibly attempting to convert Emperor Claudius II to Christianity. Now, February 14th was made a feast day in his honor by Pope Gelasius I in the year 496. There is, of course, some disagreement among historians, shocking, whether the holiday was meant to replace the pagan fertility festival of Lupercalia or to honor Valentine. Yet other stories suggest Valentine may have been killed for attempting to help Christians escape harsh Roman prisons where they were often beaten and tortured. In any case, as time went on, as it usually does, more romantic connotations came to be associated with this saint. One legend has Valentine befriending, or perhaps even falling in love with, the blind daughter of a judge or a jailer, depending on whom you read. He wrote her secret letters signed "From Your Valentine," and then restored her sight from beyond the grave, after which she went on to have a good time at that year's Lupercalia. No, I made that last bit up. By this time, Lupercalia was outlawed, as it was deemed, well, unchristian. And who outlawed it? Well, the same Pope, Pope Gelasius. What a fun guy, as these popes tended to usually be. Try the story of Pope John XII. Now, a real peach, that one. Now, courting eventually became a part of European culture down the Middle Ages. Not surprising then that February came in rather handy for young people feeling mushy. The first written connection between love and Valentine's Day appears in Chaucer's poem Parliament of Fowls, which was written in late 14th century. Some claim he simply invented the correlation and chalked it up to some poetic license, though it's entirely possible he was drawing from older courtly traditions. The Folklore Society notes that Geoffrey Chaucer mentioned Valentine's Day and describes February as the time when, quote, "every fowl cometh there to choose his mate," unquote. Jeff was the Middle Ages frat bro. You just know it. So we see that by the time of MC Jeffy C, who died in the year 1400, mid-February already had some association with Valentine's Day. One History TV recounting noted that, and I quote, "the oldest known Valentine still in existence today was a poem written in 1415 by Charles, Duke of Orleans, to his wife while he was imprisoned in the Tower of London following his capture at the Battle of Agincourt," unquote. Now, here is where things get a bit muddled and a bit funny. There are 11 Valentines commemorated by the Catholic Church. There were at least two other saints named Valentine who lived around the time of the Terni Valentine. Because his origins are so obscure, he was actually removed from the general Roman calendar by the Roman Catholic Church in 1969, even though he is still technically considered a saint. If the origin of love is a fount with no known coordinates, the origin of the day of love is just as mysterious. But those are among the prevailing myths about the origin of Valentine's Day. These myths aside, how did Valentine's Day become a hallmark holiday? Closer to modern times, Americans likely began exchanging handmade valentines in the early 1700s. In the 1840s, Esther A. Howland began selling the first mass-produced valentines in America. Howland, known as the mother of the valentine, made elaborate creations with real lace, ribbons, and colorful pictures known as scrap. And in 1913, Hallmark Cards of Kansas City, which is the largest city in Missouri. The Kansas City in Kansas is a whole other city. It's very confusing. But then again, Hallmark Cards of Kansas City in Missouri began mass producing Valentine's. February has not been the same ever since. February is also Black History Month, but ask how many people in India know about that. Now, these days, according to the Greeting Card Association, which is a fully real association in the United Kingdom, an estimated 145 million Valentine's Day cards are sent each year, making Valentine's Day the second largest card-sending holiday of the year, only behind Christmas. Women purchase approximately 85% of all Valentines. According to market research from IBIS World, Valentine's Day sales in the US reached $17.6 billion in 2010. It was closer to $20 billion last year, according to CNBC. That number could touch $30 billion this year and in the coming, according to some other estimates. In India, Valentine's Day is still quite a novelty, of course, but that has not stopped certain elements of our great Bharatvarsh from making it seem like the return of Lord Macaulay. In many conservative societies, of course, apart from India, Valentine's Day is viewed as an alien corruption of youth. But more on that later in the podcast. But first, the accoutrements of love. Chocolates, red roses and diamonds. How the hell did that happen? I don't know what you say, I don't know what you say, but I want to dance and play. I want to dance and play. I want to play the game of love. I want you in the name of love. I want you in the name of love. Now how did we just start wanting things like red roses and hearts and teddy bears and chocolates and diamonds in the name of love? That is what we'll discuss up next. We start things off with red roses. Robert Burns, the national poet of Scotland, and the man celebrated in Burns Night, where the main attraction is haggis, which is basically animal innards, romantic, was less macabre when it came to describing his love. "Oh, my love's like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June," he said. That red, red rose, that is love, also means red, red hot business now. After all, if you've convinced the world that a set number of a certain color of a specific flower is the definition of love, you've also succeeded in ensuring that the market for said flower is thriving. The polar vortex has gripped North America in its cold, cold clutches, but legions of young men and women clutched instead a bunch of dozen red roses in their hands, sold to them at a premium because, well, Valentine's Day. In the middle of winter, where do these roses even come from? Not from any greenhouse in the middle of America that is shivering to death right now, certainly. That is because several Central and South American countries grow red roses to send across to the US, so much so that according to one estimate, Americans spent nearly $2 billion on flowers on Valentine's Day in 2016. Economist Alex Tabarrok calls the red rose a truly global product. The idea of the red rose as the symbol of love is again a vestige of Greek and Roman iconography. From symbolizing Aphrodite to Venus, the goddess of love, to the virtue of Mother Mary, the red rose has meant business for millennia. From William Shakespeare to Robert Burns to Gertrude Stein, they have all fallen under the spell of the whorls of the red, red rose, ensuring that even in the century number 21, after the passing of that very Mother Mary's son, the red rose remains a multi-billion dollar commodity. 12 long-stemmed red roses in hand, what do you need next? You need chocolates. "All you need is love, but a little chocolate now and then doesn't hurt," said Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts. Now, chocolates shouldn't come as a surprise choice as a Valentine's Day favorite. Its reputation as an aphrodisiac is storied, its representation as an item of decadence well-established. A commercially mass-produced bar of sweetness to become the proxy to establish heartfelt sentiments of love? Well, now that is a leap that has centuries of history behind it. The Aztecs considered chocolate an aphrodisiac. Quick biochemistry lesson now for you. One of the most useful compounds in chocolate, love compound if you must, is something called phenethylamine, or PEA, which can trigger the release of endorphins, that is, happy hormones. Additionally, PEA enables the activity of dopamine, which, as we all know, is the happiness molecule, which is also, by the way, involved in the process of sexual arousal. Now, the biochemistry might not have been known to the Aztecs, but the reactions to chocolate certainly were. Montezuma, the famed Aztec emperor, allegedly consumed as many as 50 cups of his preferred love drug before he visited his harem of 600 women. As the Smithsonian magazine noted, and I quote, "It was a highly prized luxury item among Mayan and Aztec upper-class elites who were known to savor a drink that combined roasted cacao beans with cornmeal, vanilla, honey, and chilies. Cacao beans were as valuable as a commodity as gold and were even used to pay taxes levied by Aztec rulers," unquote. The Spanish conquistadors brought this love drug back with them to Europe after all the looting and pillaging, etc. And it was the beginning then of a new, beautiful, bounteous relationship in Europe. By the early 1600s, chocolate houses were the places to be. One such shop opened on Gracechurch Street in 1657 in London, advertising chocolate as a West Indian drink which cures and preserves the body of many diseases. Now, across the channel in France, Madame de Sévigné documented heavy chocolate consumption throughout the court at that byword of decadence, Versailles. Louis XIV drank it daily. Madame du Barry apparently infused chocolate and amber to stimulate her many, many lovers. The Smithsonian magazine went on to note that when Marie Antoinette married Louis XVI in 1770, she brought her own personal chocolate maker to Versailles. The official chocolate maker to the Queen created such recipes as chocolate mixed with orchid bulb for strength, chocolate with orange blossom to calm the nerves, or chocolate with sweet almond milk to aid the digestion, unquote. All of this excessive use of chocolate was still largely in liquid form in Europe, and chocolate was still a fairly pricey extravagance. But the coming together of a popular late winter, early spring holiday celebrating love, that is Valentine's Day, and the attribution of chocolate as an item inspiring lust was the perfect recipe for the emergence of chocolates as objet du jour in the popular imagination. Sugar was still a pricey commodity in Europe, and the Europeans had yet to figure out a way to eat chocolate in solid form. And that's when we have Cadbury. It was Victorian England, and while Victorian, as a term, is now a substitute for conservative attitudes, the abiding feeling back then was decadence and a rather adventurous attitude towards sex, even if very strictly private. Richard Cadbury, whose British family had manufactured chocolate, was searching for a way to use the pure cocoa butter that was extracted from the process that Cadbury had invented to make a more palatable drinking chocolate. His solution was eating chocolates, which he packaged in lovely boxes that he designed himself. A marketing genius, Cadbury began putting the cupids and the rosebuds on heart-shaped boxes in 1861. Even when the chocolates had been eaten, people could use these beautiful boxes to save such mementos as love letters. Over in America, one Milton Hershey of the eponymous Hershey's launched the production of teardrop-shaped kisses, so-called because of the smooching noise that the chocolate made as it was manufactured. Mass-produced at an affordable cost, the kisses were advertised as a most nourishing food. With Jean Harlow, the screen siren of the 1930s, dressed in sequins and feathers, cavorting atop heart-shaped pillows, and seductively nibbling on, well, chocolates, the transformation of chocolate as the ultimate food of decadent love and the symbol of romantic love was complete. Roses done, chocolates done. Next up, the most expensive of the lot that has come to be associated with romantic love, diamonds. If you ever thought why ad men, those men on Madison Avenue, made quite as much money as they did, and in some cases still do, look no further than that stone that has become de rigueur for marriage proposals. Diamonds. Are they a girl's best friend? Well, not until an ad campaign and Marilyn Monroe said so. Diamonds are not exactly rare, would you believe? And the forever in Diamonds Are Forever was more to hammer home the point that consumers should not resell these stones than it is to attribute eternal love or eternity to diamonds, which in fact can be chipped, shattered, discolored, or incinerated to ash. So diamonds are not exactly forever. The diamond invention, as Edward J. Epstein called it in his fantastic piece for The Atlantic, way back in the 1980s, was the quintessential Mad Men scam. The creation of the idea that diamonds are rare and valuable and are essential signs of esteem. Now, this whole thing was a scam. Until the late 19th century, diamonds were found in very few places around the world. A few riverbeds in India, some parts of Brazil, etc. Golconda in Andhra Pradesh accounted for most of the world's diamond supply, which was not very much in the first place, just a few pounds a year back in the late 19th century. In 1870, things changed. Huge diamond mines were discovered near the Orange River in South Africa, and diamonds started being mined in the tons. The market had a diamond surplus. For a substance that does not have much intrinsic value and was expensive only owing to its perceived scarcity, this was a death blow. The Atlantic magazine article went on to say, and I quote, "The British businessmen operating the South African mines recognized that only by maintaining the fiction that diamonds were rare and scarce and inherently valuable could they protect their investments and buoy diamond prices. They did so by launching a South Africa-based cartel called the De Beers Consolidated Mines, now simply De Beers, in 1888, and meticulously extending the company's control over all facets of the diamond trade in the ensuing decades. So they not only controlled the supply, but they went ahead to create an illusion that the demand was also very high. Now, how did that happen? Harry Oppenheimer, the son of the founder of De Beers, met with a New York-based ad agency called NW Ayer. The folks at Ayer then proceeded to pull out some magical thinking. Tell young men that diamonds, and only diamonds, were synonymous with romance, and the size of the stone bought was proportional to the man's love and professional as well as personal success. And to tell young women that courtship must involve a diamond, and their own worth, that is the women's own worth, could be measured by the size of the diamond they were being pursued with. And then enter movie stars and Hollywood profiles in the exercise. I'll have what she's having became the mantra for the middle-class wage earner when she saw that Hollywood royalty wore it. For the man, it became a matter of ego, and thus was born the myth of the diamond. Try selling a diamond and you'll know just how much of a con you have bought into. An idea is the most powerful thing in the world. What De Beers sold us and continues to sell us was a powerful marketing spiel. The price of diamonds has not seen a huge dip ever, even through the troughs of the Great Depression. Even famously stoic societies were swayed. As Epstein wrote in his piece, in 1967 when the campaign began, less than 5% of betrothed Japanese women had a diamond engagement ring. By 1981, that figure had risen to 60%, and Japan had become the second largest market after the United States for diamond engagement rings. De Beers conjured up a $1 billion a year diamond market in Japan, where matrimonial custom had survived feudal revolutions, world wars, industrialization, and even the American occupation. What broke it? An ad. A 2014 report by Bain indicated that the biggest market for diamonds in this decade will be China and India, partly due to the rise in the trend of the diamond ring for engagement proposals. Too long didn't read or too long didn't listen. The fact of the matter is, as far as diamonds are concerned, we've been had.
The Deep Dive podcast series.
What's love got to do with it?
As I come to the end of this podcast talking about how the accessories of love have all been commercialized and more often than not, they're a bit of a con, to dismiss Valentine's Day as merely a Hallmark holiday is a bit easy. Often, it's also a rather elitist stand to take. As writer Reema Modgil once noted, and I quote, "The one good thing Valentine's Day has achieved in a country like India is to give the repressed young in small towns a reason to celebrate each other with visible signs of affection, the few instances when their faces have been blackened by the moral police notwithstanding. Any occasion that gives the young a chance to express love in a country where an acceptable form of communication between the sexes is eve-teasing and even rape, hello Delhi, should be celebrated regardless of its commercial intentions," unquote. And I agree. It was not any different this year. We saw some skirmishes in Hyderabad by the Bajrang Dal. We've seen the Pink Chatti campaign as a response to these kind of skirmishes in the past. We know of several instances, even this year, of young Indians having been beaten up by thugs who claim Valentine's Day is not part of Indian culture. To them, I can't help but pose the obvious question, what is Indian culture? This past Valentine's Day was also the first since Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code was read down by the Supreme Court. So love is important. Love in any era is important. The opportunity to celebrate our love for someone, whoever, whatever gender, whatever sex they may be, is not often granted in India unless it also came with sanctioned norms requiring parental and societal approval and of course a wedding to consecrate it, to legitimize this love. In a country that so easily falls into a pattern of hate, isn't it almost necessary that we protect the sanctity of the one day set aside for love, even though the origins of this day may be in foreign shores? Love always trumps hate. It's trite to say it, but it is what it is. And in these difficult times, we would do well to remember it and live by it. There are reams of romantic poetry I could end this story with, but it is Dr. Seuss I enlist. "We are all a little weird, and life is a little weird. And when we find someone whose weirdness is compatible with ours, we join up with them in mutual weirdness and call it love," he said. Perfect. And also, diamonds are a con. Thank you for joining us.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast. And you have been listening to Money Control.